Laurie Garrett on the spread of contagious diseases in a world out of balance. You are about to hear part two of an hour-long talk by Laurie Garrett, author of The Coming Plague. In part one, she reported on malaria, cholera, and tuberculosis. As one of the few reporters who had the courage to cover the 1995 outbreak of Ebola in Zaire, she gave a first-hand account of the spread and containment of one of the most frightening and incurable newly emerging diseases. In today's segment, Laurie Garrett begins by responding to a commonly asked question. Have some of these new global diseases been created and spread by individuals or government agencies? And are these emerging new diseases a national security risk? Laurie Garrett.
The president ordered a 23 federal agency-wide investigation and asked the 23 federal agencies that range from the CIA and DOD all the way to the logical health agencies, one, do you think from the perspective of your agency that emerging diseases really are a major problem, a growing problem, a bigger problem than, say, 10 years ago? Two, if so, what role can your agency play in this problem? And finally, what resources do you need? There was amazing unanimity of response from the 23 agencies, and it resulted in a report given to the president in July. And it basically said, yeah, we all think this is a big problem. Some of us hadn't even looked at it until you, Mr. President, asked, and now we're kind of freaked out about it. We think this has got to be considered a national security concern. And in particular, those in the security community, the National Security Council, the DOD, the State Department, and all the CIA, said, you know, come to think of it, we can't tell the difference between a naturally emerging disease and a deliberate disease infliction. And in particular, they were persuaded by the fact that the Aum Shinrikyo cult had planned, after releasing sarin gas in the Tokyo subway, to next use Clostridium. And that would have really sickened most of Japan. They were also impressed by the fact that an Ohio militia group had successfully mail-order-received Yersinia pestis, the cause of plague, and was planning to unleash plague somewhere in the United States, and that Saddam Hussein had successfully ordered and received 32 tons of bacterial growth medium, far more than, say, all the collective universities of California would ever use in the normal course of research. All these factors combined were very persuasive to the security community. We have a bioweapons convention. It's supposed to protect us and ensure that everybody who signed it will never do these nasty things. But the truth is it's never had enforcement capability or verification capability. And the lack of verification is this issue of transparency. We can't tell a genuine terrorist element or what have you from a natural disease emergence. As to whether this ever occurred in the past, certainly we know that at least two outbreaks of disease in the former Soviet Union were due to their own experiments gone awry and leaking. And there's always been controversial evidence of a similar episode occurring in the southwest of the United States about 30 years ago. One of the things that I'm particularly concerned about is that the new direction in molecular biology research that's very powerful now is isolation of virulence genes and transmissibility genes, trying to figure out exactly how the organisms do things like kill you or like spread in the air between people. Once isolated, it doesn't take an advanced molecular biology training to figure out how to engineer in a virulence gene into an already highly transmissible agent or vice versa. So I think this is cause for serious concern and alert. Well, one of the things that has put this whole issue of emerging diseases suddenly on the front burner of the national security circles in Washington was the emergence, or I should say reemergence after about a 70-year hiatus, of pneumonic plague in India in September of 94. When it first appeared, it caught everybody by surprise because the World Health Organization had determined 20 years earlier that India had successfully eradicated Yersinia pestis. Just remember, we've only eradicated one species. Nevertheless, they thought they had. And the conditions responsible for bringing it forward appear to have involved a earthquake that occurred in the eastern part of the state of Maharashtra, the capital being Bombay, in September of 93. A devastating earthquake killed 10,000 people, leveled 52 villages. The people, in their panic, took whatever existing structures they had, sealed in all their harvested crops, and left town. And when they felt it was safe to return and opened up these structures, they were overwhelmed by fleas and rats that had, of course, taken advantage of the stored grains. By August of 94, some of the villages in this region were seeing bubonic plague rates, meaning carried by the flea, as high as 10% of the populations of the respective villages. Some of these people, in panic, unable to obtain tetracycline to treat their illness, went to beautiful Surat to the north in the state of Gujarat. Surat is a massive city of hundreds of thousands of people with 0% unemployment. It's a center for unskilled labor from all over the Indian subcontinent. It's also a place with no real sewage systems. It would be polite to say substandard housing for most of the city, no electricity, no safe running water. And in some neighborhoods, particularly where it appears that the plague first, pneumonic plague first appeared, the human-to-toilet ratio is 750 people per toilet. And after a special festival for the elephant-headed god Ganesh, which was a time when you had huge congregations of people frolicking and celebrating, among them people who'd gone with untreated bubonic plague that had therefore advanced to their lungs and become pneumonic, the following day the first cases showed up here on the plague ward at the civil hospital. The plague ward was quickly overwhelmed with the disease, and the world is very fortunate that there were three courageous, smart young doctors who made the call. This looks like plague, though of course they'd never seen plague before, drawing from their textbook training. And of course it's turned out that they were correct, though there were many who denounced them and claimed they'd made a misdiagnosis. They tried to immediately get the area under proper quarantine, but it took many days, about 10 days, to convince the central government in Delhi that there was a bona fide plague. And then they finally sent the military in to help keep the wrong people from coming out of the hospital and the wrong from going in. Until then, it had been utter chaos, especially because the BBC had gone on the radio and said that there was a virus, a mystery virus, loose in Surat. So 450,000 people in 48 hours got on trains and went home. Meaning as far away as Kathmandu, as Dhaka, Bangladesh, down to Madras, over to Delhi. Had this actually been a non-treatable airborne microbe, it would have been within 48 hours all over the entire Indian subcontinent, and surely within 72 would have spread into China. And this is without the assistance of airplanes. This is just trains. There's been quite a number of studies recently about the effect of global warming on the vectors of disease. As the water temperature of the ocean rises, the algal populations are getting larger, and they can carry not only cholera, but literally thousands of different microorganisms can be carried in algae and then be ingested by shellfish and so on. But we're also seeing some interesting studies that point to changes in the patterns for insects, particularly those that might carry yellow fever, dengue, hemorrhagic fever, and malaria. Certainly, with global warming, higher and higher altitudes will get warmer, so they may become more permissive ecologies for insects. Then the other point that we know is the case with global warming is that we're witnessing the demise of fragile intermediary species that play a control role because they consume insects, amphibians being a key, but also birds. And it's very frightening to see that the predators of our predators, of our the vectors that carry our predators, are decreasing in number. And I invite you to look in the chapter about Lyme disease to see what it means when you get such a gross disparity in predatory populations versus the passive populations, and recognize that that suddenly can unleash a whole range of disease opportunities that you hadn't possibly anticipated. We need collectively, all of us, whether you're a health provider, a carpenter, a plumber, or a university professor, we need to undergo a really profound collective change of consciousness about the microecology. And I think it's doable. Because 20 years ago, how many people in this room knew what an ozone hole was, or gave a darn? How many thought twice about chucking a beer can out the window when you drove on an open highway, or gave much thought to endangered species? We have succeeded all over the world in undergoing a profound global consciousness change about our macroecology. And now you can travel in incredibly remote areas and hear people talking about solar power or ways to clean up their polluted rivers and so on. We need to undergo an equally dramatic, but I'm afraid more rapid, we don't have as much time, change in consciousness about how we view the microecology. And I think it's fair to say that most people don't give a second thought to the microecology, even the microecology in their own duodenum, in their own gut. They don't think about it until they're sick. But we need to really profoundly ask the questions, how do our activities as this big, lumbering, huge species on the planet affect the microbes, our predators? And what are the things that we do that constantly aid and abet the microbes? Now, if we can begin to identify, and I think in my book I lay out quite a number of them, what are those ways in which we aid and abet the microbes fairly idiotically and routinely, we can come up with policy solutions that target what I call the amplification systems of disease. For example, it's utterly irrational that in the world today the majority of all medicinal injections are given with contaminated syringes. That should just be, as a matter of, you know, global collective consciousness, considered immoral, irrational, and something that those of us wealthy enough to do something about should correct. Period. It is insane and irrational that blood products can still be distributed in much of the world without undergoing any kind of sterilization or cleaning, so that we actively give as blood transfusions or blood product in many places in the world contaminated product that we know will in the end bring on some secondary disease, you know, cure the short-term problem but keep the long-term problem. And then finally, there is a tier of personal responsibility and personal change that I think everybody can do right away. That means you don't abuse the precious armamentarium that we do have. No one should take antibiotics if they don't have a bacterial versus viral infection, ever. No excuse. And no one should be given a prescription for antibiotics and stop taking them just because the symptoms ended. In fact, if you right now in your home have leftover antibiotics, you misbehaved. There should never be leftover antibiotics in your home, because you should only be taking them fully and completely until your entire purchase dose is utilized. Otherwise, what are you doing? You're only curing the symptoms. You're not obliterating the infection. Now, about 40% of all prescriptions for antibiotics in this country are given for viral ailments. And the majority of all prescriptions now, especially for children, are using way overboard levels of antibiotics. For example, I always say it's like going at the problem with a cruise missile when a pea shooter would have been adequate. Physicians know resistance is out there. They're practicing defensive medicine, often under tremendous pressure now in managed care systems where they're not even allowed to order tests on you, and they're not allowed to spend more than 10 minutes with you, maybe 5. So they're ordering the broad spectrum, the most powerful antibiotics, just in case. The problem is that we now know that if you take broad spectrum antibiotics inappropriately, you develop broad spectrum antibiotic resistance. So you actually hasten the course of this. Well, the reason this is a community responsibility issue is that it's not just that you raise the possibility that you or your family members will breed antibiotic resistant strains that will then make your illness last longer. But if your child goes to childcare, they spread that strain to the other kids in childcare. I mean, how many parents here have had the thing where, you know, your kid has the ear infection that never goes away, and the whole family is constantly having waves of illness brought home by the kid from school or from childcare, and you thought, wait a minute, I'm an adult, how come I'm not immune to all these things as they come in? The organisms are different. They've changed. They're not the same organisms your immune system saw when you were a child, and the antibiotics are not working as well. What role does the widespread livestock use of antibiotics play in terms of diminishing the capacity of these precious drugs? Obviously, this is a very serious problem. Very serious. It's hard to establish a smoking gun trail that will stand up to the scrutiny of the meatpacking industry, or the poultry industry, or the egg and dairy industry. Because, obviously, if you get sick 2 weeks from now with a strain of salmonella that will not respond to antibiotics, how can we prove it was because of some eggs you ate that no longer, obviously, are in your refrigerator for us to study 2 weeks ago, or 3 weeks ago, or a month ago? Fortunately, there are a few cases where very unique epidemiological circumstances have been at play, allowing to demonstrate clearly that antibiotic resistance did pass from the animals to the consumer. The most common thing that we've been able to prove definitely occurs is the use of cow manure as fertilizer. Often the manure will contain antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria that have been cultured inside the cattle. And crops grown in that manure will be coated with it. So, for example, there was an antibiotic-resistant outbreak in organic apple cider because the apples had been falling from the trees into the manure, and they had pressed the manure with the apples without chlorine bleaching them because they didn't want to use do the bad thing for organic foods and blah, blah, blah. And the result was that people got very, very sick from drinking this apple cider. That's just one classic example, but clearly the widespread use in the industry is out of control. And in fact, now with bovine growth hormone, that product weakens the immune systems of the cows, so they actually are more susceptible to infection, so antibiotic use is escalating. Last year, before another whole round of budget cutting started, a survey of all the 50 states and the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico revealed that 12 states in the United States had nobody on payroll to monitor food and water for microbial infection or contamination. 34 states had less than one person on payroll to monitor the safety of your food and water for every 1 million residents of the state. Only 2 states have more than 2 people per million residents monitoring your food and water. And the interesting thing is, one of the better states is Washington, the state of Washington. When E. coli 0157, a new microorganism never seen before as far as we know on planet Earth, a new mutant strain, surfaced in the jack-in-the-boxes of Seattle, causing death and illness in small children, everybody said, well, what's with the state of Washington? How did this thing emerge there? It turns out it actually had emerged and killed people in the state of Nevada 6 months earlier, but Nevada has no more public health infrastructure, and they weren't noted. So if I were a resident of the state of Washington, I'd be PO'd at Nevada. And this gets amplified by the fact that the CDC has no legal right to go into any health intervention in any state without being invited in. So they can't come to Berkeley. I don't care what the epidemic is here, unless Berkeley requests assistance from Sacramento and Sacramento requests assistance from Atlanta. Well, if you've got nobody on payroll to watch and to say, oops, there's a problem, then who's going to call Atlanta? And that's the state we're in most of our states right now, is that there is an inadequate surveillance capacity for everything, not just food and water, for hospital outbreaks, for school outbreaks, for tuberculosis, for everything. Now, the other lesson we're learning today, the other problem we're experiencing, is that even countries that had attained a reasonable level of public health infrastructural development are going backwards, and in some cases at a dramatic pace. Since the Soviet Union collapsed, most of the Soviet states are experiencing widespread epidemics, and their basic healthcare structures have collapsed. This is Russia. This is what has happened in Russia since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And in fact, this is dated 1993. Diphtheria has now reached such a level in Russia, they're looking at 250,000 cases of an entirely preventable and curable disease. Measles, totally out of control now. Gonorrhea and syphilis, completely out of control. Tuberculosis, sweeping across all the former Soviet Union, mostly in drug-resistant forms. Pertussis, or whooping cough, completely sweeping across the region. And an interesting thing, the diphtheria epidemic in particular is sending a warning shot to us here. It turns out that all you have to do is go about 2 years without immunizing an adequate number of children, and you start to build up a high level of wild-type diphtheria in your population. And it turns out adults who are immunized as children, thought to have lifetime protection, are not able to withstand an assault when they're in their 40s, 50s, or 60s to new reintroduction of wild-type diphtheria. So what we see in Russia is that lots of the death is occurring in adults who were previously immunized against diphtheria. And lest you think this is a third world problem, this is where we stand in the United States on successful, or I should say non-successful, immunization of our children. Houston has only succeeded in immunizing in any given year 10% of its under 2-year-olds according to international standards. In my hometown in New York City, we're looking at about 38% successfully immunized, but look at California statewide, only 48%. Less than half of all children are adequately immunized by their second birthday according to international standards. We rank behind El Salvador, behind Guatemala, behind Bangladesh in by age 2 vaccination. And, you know, we could really ask how many families would adequately vaccinate their children at all ever if it weren't illegal to go into the school system by age 5 without full vaccination. I'm very distressed to see that we've lost our sense of what public health really is. Before we began this current age of attitude about health and medicine that says, blame the victim, you know. If you had a heart attack, it's because you ate butter. If you want to live long, you must exercise and you must eat the right things, and it's not our responsibility collectively to ensure health, but each of you individually to ensure your own personal health. Well, that may work for things like preventing heart disease, but it won't work for contaminated waters, contaminated foods, contagious disease. There's a reason these have always been public health functions, because the only effective measures are those taken on a society-wide basis, which means by government. And the problem is what we see happening right now all over the world, and very acutely right here in the United States, is that we're cutting government spending and public health right and left. We're destroying our own public health infrastructure, even as we can see that the countries that have done this before us have suffered epidemics wave after wave. I spent a good deal of the summer following the situation in Los Angeles County and reporting on it on the ground for my newspaper, Newsday. It's an interesting footnote. I was covering it for a newspaper in New York City, and the Los Angeles Times wasn't covering it, nor was the San Francisco Chronicle. At any rate, what's happened to L.A. County is, I'm afraid, a harbinger of what's to come nationwide, and certainly all over California. And it just hit L.A. County hardest and first because of a specific set of factors present in that county. 48% of the population of L.A. County, the highest in the nation, has no health insurance. And the politicians like to say the problem is the immigrants. Well, that 48%, less than 10% of them are immigrant population, or so-called illegal aliens. Only about 500,000 people in L.A. County can be considered illegal aliens who would be denied health care under Prop 187. The majority of the problem is, in fact, people who are legal residents of the county. So they have no health insurance. That's part one. Part two, they've had this massive recession. Part three, Prop 13 means that they have no way to raise income for the county. You have a governor that decided to run as a fiscal conservative for President of the United States and denied the county $1 billion that it had been budgeted to receive. And also, because of the tobacco and wine lobbies in this state, they denied the county the option of raising taxes on both tobacco and alcohol in the county in order to offset their crisis. By June, they were facing a $2 billion shortfall and a $13 billion budget, and as of October 1st, what they did as a resolution for it was to cut all but 10 of 45 healthcare, public health clinics and comprehensive care centers in the county, and shut down or attempt to sell off and privatize 4 out of 6 public hospitals, leaving eventually only L.A. County General, which is larger than the Pentagon in square footage, and Drew Martin Luther King Hospital, both of which are in the downtown core area in a county that has 4,000 square miles in size and no rapid transit. What will be the result? According to their own forecasts, they will almost immediately begin to see a measles epidemic. This will be followed by a whooping cough epidemic and by a tuberculosis epidemic. All prenatal care will collapse. Most well-baby programs and childhood immunization programs for the poor will collapse, will cease to exist. They say this in their own documents. Mostly sexually transmitted disease screening programs will collapse. And it can be guaranteed people will not get their children immunized, because if you have to find a way, when you're poor, to get all the way from San Bernardino, near the edge of San Bernardino County, to L.A. County General to sit in the ER with your child for 14 or 15 hours to wait for the non-trauma injuries to be taken care of so they can sneak your kid in for immunization, do you think you're going to do it? So I think we're facing a real crisis, and I think that the whole anti-immigrant sentiment has clouded it over, covered it up, made people find a scapegoat group to blame, when in fact it's all of us. And it's the fact that we have a massive uninsured population with no affordable access to health care anymore. And this is before any of the federal cuts go into place. I'm not talking about the impact of changing Medicaid or Medicare. I'm just talking about homegrown California problem. The county estimates in L.A. that if the Medicaid and Medicare cuts go in as currently envisioned, if the president is not successful with his veto attempt and a compromise resolution is not reached, the county will face another $1.5 billion shortfall next year. What the heck are they going to cut next time? Close L.A. County General? We're in a kind of unique time politically. We have an executive branch that is probably the most impotent executive branch we've dealt with in my lifetime, and a legislative branch that is bound and determined to carry out an agenda that is the most profound change in the structure of government this country has ever experienced. There is tremendous concern about this issue in the executive branch of government and among those people who are in this government bureaucracy whose job it is to do policy analysis, forecasting, and so on. This issue has not been raised once in any committee or on any of the floor discussion in either the House or the Senate. And at this time, I cannot identify any member of either the House or Senate who is interested in taking the issue on as one of their causes or one of their concerns, including the California representatives.
You heard Lori Garrett, author of The Coming Plague, in a talk on the impact of emerging diseases on our personal and collective well-being. Lori Garrett is a health and science writer for Newsday and New York Newsday, and a contributing author to AIDS in the World. She researched her recent book, The Coming Plague, as a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health. A cassette copy or a printed transcript of the full one-hour talk is $9. For $15, you get both, the audio cassette and the transcript. Send your check to TUC Radio, Box 41009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.